Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Weed Wonks, the podcast that dives deep into the nerdy details, the minutiae, the ever-fun silliness that is cannabis regulatory policy. And we do it all to help our fellow policy wonks, policymakers, regulators, business members, advocates, and the canna curious stay more informed about the changing landscape of cannabis laws and regulations. I'm your host, partner of VS Strategies. With us in spirit is Andrew Livingston, Director of Economics and Research at Vicente Cederberg. And although Andrew is cranking away at the home bunker as usual, what that means is less of us over talking and more time hearing from our amazing guest. Our guest today is Emily Kaltenbach, Senior Director of Resident States, who's been overseeing the legalization efforts in New Mexico. And we're really excited to talk to her about that. New Mexico, a sister state to Colorado, just to our south, is the most recent state that we've added to those who have legalized marijuana, depending on how, I guess, you want to capture Virginia and when they count they pass. But we're going to say New Mexico is the most recent because, most importantly, Emily is on our podcast today and we're not going to be talking about Virginia. We're going to be talking about New Mexico. And we think that they really passed an exceptional law. It's taken several years to get it done, but it's going to create a great mix of entrepreneurial opportunities for marginalized communities, as well as create a real pathway for the existing medical industry that's been helping patients for years there. And most importantly, take another bite out of the war on drugs and another step closer to achieving our goal of not only ending cannabis prohibition, but of course, ending the entire war on drugs. And so, Emily, it's so happy to have you on the podcast today. It's one that we've been watching very closely here at VS Strategies and really thrilled that New Mexico was able to get legalization across the finish line this year and looking forward to being able to vacation down there and not be a criminal because that's sweet. We don't like being a criminal. So Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jordan. I'm super excited to be here and get to meet you over the airwaves here. I know we've been communicating throughout the New Mexico legislative session, but it's awesome to be on your show and get to chat a bit about what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I will admit, and I want to talk a little bit about your background. I know that Emily is literally the crux and epicenter of a lot of the policy making and the sausage making that went into New Mexico. And I had the privilege of listening to her testify in New Mexico committee after committee, when basically the bill sponsors would, she was like the call a friend. Anytime there was like a wonky question or complicated thing, she would come in. And I had texted her that I was kind of a bit of a fanboy and becoming kind of enamored at how amazing she was in responding to all of these questions, and was like, as soon as we can do a show on New Mexico, there is no other person I would want to have on because we want to be able to dive into some of the minutiae. And you clearly kind of have a grasp of not only the big picture story and narrative that we want to tell today, but really those details of kind of what this is going to mean for businesses, for patients, for consumers, and for potential entrepreneurs as New Mexico, which I think is going to be an amazing market with a massive tourism population, really, really cool art and other things going on in the community there, as well as obviously a state that I think could use some economic development and a bit of a shot in the arm for their economy. So why don't we start at the beginning, or at least at the beginning for you? How did you get involved in drug policy reform?
It's a good question. I feel like now it's been like a decade of my career, but I grew up here in New Mexico in a rural community south of Santa Fe, where there was a lot of drug use, a lot of marijuana use, problematic, unproblematic. I really got interested in sort of this healthcare and social services at an early age. And so I went on and I was mostly doing public health work. And so I was setting up rural health clinics around the state. I was working for state government doing policy and planning for aging and long-term services. And this opportunity at DPA popped up and it seemed to resonate. It pulled together all my interests. So here I am. But I started with sort of a more of a public health perspective. Over, the last 10 years, I'm much more interested in sort of the criminal justice side and repairing the harms of prohibition from that perspective. So it's been an interesting ride, but I feel like I can pull on all my life experiences and my education. So here I am.
Yeah. And I mean, at the core of drug policy reform really is public health, right? I mean, that the reason that drug policy reform is even a thing, I think, in a lot of ways, is because it goes back to the original sin of dealing with people who have irresponsible relationships and unhealthy relationships with drugs as a criminal justice matter, right? But really, it's a public health issue, and people need to be supported as well as being given the individual freedom to live their lives how they want. And so at the core, drug policy reform really is a public health issue. It is unfortunately a criminal justice reform issue as well. But that's really what we're trying to get to, is the argument we're making is this is not a criminal justice issue. The cops shouldn't be involved almost at all. And it really needs to be about how we're taking care of people and how we're treating people in our society that, you know, either want to use drugs and don't have an unhealthy relationship with them, or need help because they've developed an unhealthy relationship with drugs over the years. And how are we going to support them through that to help them live a better life? And so I think that some people see it almost as the reverse, but I feel like you're coming with the exact kind of background we need, because I'm not a public health expert and I sometimes get beyond my depth when I get in there, and we need folks like you on the team who can be like, no, Jordan, that's nice. We appreciate your technical regulatory experience, but I actually have a background in public health, and this is why, and this is the actual talking points we should use. So, for me, I think it's like the absolute perfect person to have come in and help New Mexico. And that was really a lot of the crux of some of the questions that had to get dealt with. There were concerns about public health that came up. So, maybe we can start back, because New Mexico's journey to legalization did not start in 2021, right?
It's many years before that.
So about when did things start percolating up to the point where it really seemed like, okay, this is a viable policy issue to invest resources in to try to make progress?
Well, actually, I think Colorado was the point in which New Mexico suddenly started to pay attention. So it was, I think it was 2014 that we actually introduced a constitutional amendment, because in New Mexico, we don't have ballot initiatives, or you can't just automatically put something on the ballot to change the constitution. So we had a really regressive Republican governor. We knew there was no way that we could pass legalization. So the one way to bypass her veto pen was to actually introduce a constitutional amendment that has to get approved by the legislative body and then put onto the ballot. So that was 2014. And in 2015, we actually got it to the floor of the Senate and almost passed it off the Senate. So for me, that was the point where it became like, okay, we can do this. We just have to change sort of some of the leadership in order to get there. And, you know, public opinion was there. Like, if we had put it on the ballot, we would have won.
Yeah, I mean, and that's always the case in cannabis, is the people are ahead of the politicians on this issue. And I mean, I think it's even more true today than it was in 2014 and 2015. And that continues. The poll numbers that have come out that I've been read about in Marijuana Moment the last couple of weeks have just been amazing. I think there was one that was like 71% support legalization, and then another one that was in the 60s, and another one that was in the 50s. And it all depends on what questions you ask and how you structure your poll and what your sample size is. But, you know, I think that in a country that's so divided, this seems to be one of the very few issues that most folks can agree on. Which is pretty amazing to be at the nexus of that kind of a policy area.
The rise in public opinion. I mean, we polled this in 2007, I think. We've seen a 40-point shift in support since that time in New Mexico. So, you know, it's just, I'm not surprised when you see some of those numbers around the country.
No, I always say in public policy, it helps to be right. You know, you always want to have the hammer of like, well, we are actually right about this. And if we just stick to our guns and stand the test of time, you know, hopefully we will prevail because we are right on this issue. And cannabis prohibition is morally wrong. So New Mexico legalized through a normal bill. So at some point you had to transition strategy from a constitutional amendment that would require a vote of the people to just, we're just going to get this done the way we get everything else done. And that's by changing state statutes. When did that kind of transition come about?
So actually it was right around that same time. So 2015, a bill was introduced in the House by their then Representative Bill McCamley. And it was a big bill. It was pretty clunky. It was based mostly on Oregon's legislation. but it was, you know, it was a test and it got five committee assignments. And in New Mexico, when you get more than three, that's just the kiss of death. But also the, I think it was that in 2015 that the House was being, the leader, it had swung back to Republicans, which was like the first time in 60 years. So there was a big, you know, kibosh put on that. And so since 2015, we've just slowly been working on a bill, rewriting, introducing, testing. And actually, I'm proud to say that when people asked when we were going to legalize, I said 2021. So I knew it was going to take that long. I knew we needed a new governor. I knew it wasn't going to be in the new governor's first legislative session. It would have to be the second one. And here we are.
Yeah. And I mean, we first got involved last year in the 2020 session. And I had come, I came down to Santa Fe and had a few different meetings. And, you know, I got the sense that there was a chance, but my reading of the tea leaves was it was going to be tricky. That the House was there and the House was really strong, but there were still a bunch of senators that, you know, we had conversations with, and it just felt like, you know, they would ask questions about youth access. They would ask questions about, you know, kind of public health and public safety issues. And we would explain like, well, this is really how it plays out. And this is what it means. And this is why cannabis legalization is actually a positive for public health and safety. It's a way to resolve public health and safety concerns. It is the way, you know, regulation works because that's how we solve the problems. Prohibition is just burying your head in the sand and pretending they don't exist. And, you know, I think that it got some traction with folks, but I could just tell, you know, you can just tell when you're talking to somebody and when your answers land a little bit more flat and as opposed to when they stick. And it just felt like, okay, like we're really making progress. And there was a chance, I think, last year. I don't think it was like there was no way it was going to happen, but it definitely seemed like it was going to be a bit of a tricky hill to navigate. And the bill ended up dying, I believe, in the Senate. Before it even made it over to the House. Is that correct?
Yeah, that version did. We started it in the Senate last year. And before that, it had gotten through the House completely. So we knew we could get it through the House. So we started on the Senate side. I mean, the difference between yesterday, it feels like it was just yesterday, last year and this year is that we don't have those senators there anymore. So the election happened. And, you know, we, New Mexico, you know, got rid of a handful of those really conservative Democrats, and they were replaced with Democrats who ran on legalization. So that was the big shift from last year to this year.
And I think the governor was definitely a supporter the whole time, but I feel like the difference between last year and this year in terms of the level of interjection, the level of like, we are going to get this done come hell or high water, really picked up. And maybe like, how do you think that, because the governor's got the bully pulpit, and we'll talk about how important that was. But I feel like that, did you feel like there was maybe not a shift in rhetoric, but a shift in action and a shift in pressure from the governor's office this year?
Definitely at the end. Yeah. That was different. I think it was a different approach by the governor's office than last year. It was much more targeted, focused. So I definitely think there was a change, especially in the last few weeks when it became clear that we needed a bit more pressure to get it through the Senate on time. It was really a timing issue more than anything.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, I mean, maybe this is a good, just quick mention of the good old civics lesson is New Mexico has some tight legislative timelines. Different state legislatures meet for different amounts of time. And I think New Mexico's cadence is particularly unique to some extent throughout the country. Right. So maybe we could talk about what that meant. Like there's kind of odd years and different number of days and why things are so compressed in terms of trying to get the bill passed.
As a result of the New Mexico legislative calendar, we age very quickly in a short amount of time. So yeah, we have alternating 30-day and 60-day sessions. 30 days are reserved for budget and whatever's on the governor's call. from a policy perspective, and 60 days, the real budget and policy session, which is every other year. So that also was a difference from last year to this year. Last year was a 30-day session. We were trying to get something through really quickly. The other thing is that I think New Mexico is one of the few last unpaid legislatures in the whole country. Makes a big difference. And so that's part of why it's such a short session. But, and then if things die, I mean, you run out, the clock runs out, and sorry, you have to start all over again the next year.
Yeah. And that's kind of what happened last year. I mean, a 30-day session, it's almost impossible to get something that isn't fait accompli passed. And I think the Senate, it was in a Senate committee. I went down and testified even. And then I think they met a second time and they voted, and it looked like even when I came down to testify, the votes just, they weren't quite there. They were close. But as you said, elections happen and elections have consequences. And, some folks who weren't in favor of legalization are no longer in the New Mexico Senate. And some folks who are in favor came along, and 2021 was the year that amazing things have happened. And so, but again, not the most linear path, right? I think at one point we were tracking six different pieces of legislation or seven different pieces of legislation between House and Senate versions that had been introduced. And it took a while to kind of winnow them down to like the two leading candidates. There was a Democratic bill and a Republican bill. And even then it didn't get done. So what was the process like working through the different pieces of legislation? There was an industry backed one. There was one the one that ended up passing was really the one that DPA was kind of the lead behind in terms of drafting. So how did all of those bills kind of get compromised into what finally became the vehicle?
I mean, the bill that Representative Martinez and Romero, can I give a shout out to them? As sponsors, amazing. They're doing it for the right reasons. Social justice and equity were front and center. And honestly, that was the difference. You could take all those, you know, other bills, industry, Republican, whatever you want to call them, and they did not include social justice and equity. The bill, you know, House Bill 2, which was ultimately the bill that passed in a special session, House Bill 12 in the regular session, you know, that was the driving force. Racial justice and equity were front and center in that. So, you know, I wouldn't say though that the bill that ended up passing didn't have industry support, because I think it did. You know, there was definitely a split in the industry itself over a handful of issues. So plant count was one, was probably the big one actually that, excuse me, came down to it. So, you know, I think it was clear that Representative Martinez's bill was going to be the bill. That was going to be the vehicle. And it was just looking at all of those other bills and pulling out bits and pieces and integrating it into that. I think leadership made it clear at the beginning that was the bill that was going to move all the way through. And everyone had to come to the table and make sure it was the right one.
So, yeah, I mean, we had been hearing the whole time that HB 12 was going to be the vehicle, and for the exact reasons you outlined, that it was the vehicle that started from a framework of social justice, of racial justice. And that was at the core of that bill. Obviously, there's a variety of components that cannabis legalization incorporates. And there were different bills that we saw different pieces come from. And, you know, the industry, I think, negotiated on various issues. They had concerns. They're folks who have made investments for a long time in New Mexico. And I don't think it's the time for this podcast to dive into it, but there certainly have been issues in the New Mexico medical market for years to come. And there are people who invested a lot of time and energy and their savings into helping cannabis patients. And this was an opportunity for them to really reap the rewards of that investment beyond, you know, just helping folks. And I think that it was an interesting conversation to figure out, how do you balance that with allowing new entrepreneurs, allowing new people to come in? There were conversations about residency requirements. And, you know, we had talked to a lot of folks. Obviously, our client coming from Colorado was not a big fan of residency requirements. And we had to really share with folks, like, every time we see it these days, people get sued and it's not going to be constitutional. And, you know, it's something that really hurt Colorado. I mean, I think Colorado's market, and most importantly, patients and consumers in Colorado, were really harmed by our residency requirement. And it took us years to get rid of it. And we were talking to folks being like, it sounds great. But once you have to live with it, the same people that were supportive of Colorado's residency requirement are the same people who spent years and years and years and umpteen hundreds of thousands of dollars on getting rid of it, because they quickly realized, wait a minute, like, this sounded good, but it's causing more problems than it protects. And so we had to work through all of those issues. We had to work through plant count issues. And it seems like there was a lot of compromise, even with the Republican bill that had a lot more local control features and things like that, that kind of eventually sorted themselves out as things moved forward.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to say there were a few things taken from a few of those bills, but for the most part, you know, it stayed intact. In the end, I think it was good that there was some sort of language around production management. In the end, you know, I think that actually is going to be a benefit, especially to smaller businesses. And, you know, some of the other things we took from the Republican bill was around consignment, which I liked, actually, of, you know, incentivizing consignment, especially for, again, these small, you know, folks want to get into the business, having the capital is tough. And, you know, having to buy your inventory outright is tough. And so I like this idea of consignment. So, you know, there were a few things here or there. Also, you know, not allowing, well, changing the language so that the governor didn't have the power to decide if there was going to be interstate. Am I good with that? Interstate and interstate. I always get, it's interstate commerce and in more global.
Interstate is the one we want, and intrastate is what we live with today.
Exactly. So, so I think they all had some really good points. But it, you know, as I said before, it came down to equity and social justice.
Yeah. And I love the fact that you said production management. That really makes me personally about as happy as you possibly could have today, maybe without knowing it, because Colorado is really the only state that actually engages in production management. And it's a concept that I created when I worked at the Marijuana Enforcement Division. The campaign, Vicente Cederberg, when they were lobbying, the only thing that they lobbied for really during implementation was the authority and requirement for the Marijuana Enforcement Division to manage production, because we felt like that was a real risk and it was something that needed to be managed and controlled. But what we've seen most other states do is come out with a very simple production cap, right? A plant count cap. And that's what the conversations were. And I've had conversations with folks from all over the country and someone in a governor's office in a state that's debating legalization or was this session. And they kept saying to me, no, we need to control production and we need to figure out like, what is the actual, and they were like, how do we figure out how much cannabis we need in the state? Like, what do we do? And I'm like, you can't, it doesn't work that way. Like, you know, that's why communist Russia failed. And they were like, no, we need to figure it out. And I'm like, we're not going to be communist Russia. And I was like, that's like, production quotas was literally like the hallmark of part of their economic system. Production management, the way we've created here, just puts a governor on things, right? It means that you can't engage in speculative cultivation the way we created it. So you can't just show up and put 100 million plants in the ground and hope that you have a market to sell it. You start out in tier one and you work your way up through the tiers to make sure that, one, you have kind of a level playing field of where people start and everyone can start their business. And it's more about the quality of your operations than your access to capital. But also, you don't have people manipulating the market through speculative cultivation. You don't have people ending up like, oh, darn, I don't have enough market for 100 million marijuana plants. I guess it's got to go out of state, right? And the other way around, right?
I mean, what people, there was just this fear of overproduction when underproduction is also, you know, a real concern as well, especially for medical patients.
Yeah. I mean, underproduction is as dangerous as overproduction, right? When you try to do this. And I think the truth is that there is no formula. There is no magic formula that's going to tell you the exact number of plants or square feet or anything else that you need to satisfy demand for cannabis in any state. It just doesn't, There's a reason we don't do that in any other commodity in the country, that we let the market decide how much there needs to be. But at the same time, I think we recognize in cannabis that if you want to have an equitable industry, if you want to disincentivize diversion, you can't just let people go willy-nilly, right? You need to manage it in a way, but you can't control it. And there's such a difference between those two that I was really happy when, you know, the language I think that came out by the time it was all said and done. And I had some interesting conversations with MPP folks and some other folks that were working on kind of that last, which was really one of the last policy issues that needed to be sought after. And I remember I had a call with the lobbyist that works with our client, and he kept talking to me about plant counts and plant counts. And I like spent, I don't know, half hour, 45 minutes on the phone with him and explained plant counts and production management and all the different systems around the country. And I talked to him 3 days later and he's like, everybody in New Mexico is now using production management instead of plant counts. He's like, I think it worked. And I was like, yeah, I was like, we just want a good system. We're not saying it has to be this or it has to be that. We're just saying, don't control something that you can't control. It's not knowable. So you have to, which is hard in policymaking. Most policymakers want to know. The acceptance that it doesn't work is hard. And I think where everything landed will drive forward a system in New Mexico that will meet demand, that will be flexible because patients and consumers come first and foremost in all of these, but will also lead to an equitable playing field as the existing industry starts getting going, as new entrepreneurs join the market. And that will lead to a more vibrant marketplace for all consumers. You mentioned another one that I want to talk about a little bit more, which is consignment, because while production management and controlling production is something we talk about all over the country with different variations and permutations, consignment feels like a bit new. Consignment feels like you in New Mexico may have created an entirely new thing. I have not, and I could be wrong, but I'm not aware of any state that really talked about that or thought about it and included it as a goal in their law. So how is that actually going to work?
Yeah, I mean, it started out with some real restrictive language that wasn't going to go anywhere. Basically, you couldn't get licensed to be a retailer unless you allowed consignment. Now you actually get a reduction in your licensing fee if you consign products. So, I mean, what I like about the New Mexico law is that you have this diversity in licenses. You can be a grower or a manufacturer. You can create your special green chili cannabis product and, you know, put it out in the retail market, consign it and see where it goes. And so, you know, retailers who decide to take on consignment products get a cut. And I think that's important for equity. Small businesses, you know, I think actually the retail license is probably the least expensive license you can have in some senses, because, you know, you just have to set up a storefront and you can literally, you could take 100% of your inventory on consignment if you wanted.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the areas that we always think about when we talk about it. Did you create an equitable market structure? Well, what are the barriers to entry, right? And we just saw this with Illinois. They were the belle of the ball and everybody was like, oh man, this is great. And there's a lot of really good things in Illinois' legalization. But when it comes to licensing, the barriers to entry to obtaining a license in Illinois make it very hard for an equity program, a true equity program, to be effective. And so I'm going to ask the same question I ask of every single cannabis state policy initiative, and I already know the answer, but we want to celebrate it. Are there caps on state licenses in New Mexico?
There are no caps on state licenses.
That is hands down the most important issue, because if you actually want to have equity, you can't have a licensing process that costs seven figures to apply to try to participate in the business. Because it turns out most people on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale don't have $5 million to apply to see if they're allowed to start their business. And instead, New Mexico's really gone in another direction. Not only have they created micro licenses and licenses designed for equity, but you've doubled down with this consignment concept. And that is all it is. Cannabis is a commodity, folks. It's just functions just like any other, you know, commodity, and economics matter, and barriers to entry are the biggest problem with business formation when you try to create an equitable space. And by thinking about all these creative solutions, you really, I think, have created a pathway to equity that maybe doesn't have, like, we have 57 licenses reserved for equity candidates defined in this narrow manner, but instead you just have opened the doors for people in a way that are, that just don't cost as much money to get their business off the ground. And that is probably what will lead to a more equitable market than anything else, because barriers to entry, like in any business, are the biggest problem that people have to deal with. And in cannabis, that gets tenfold when you cap the number of licenses and then try to figure out stuff that the market can only decide.
Yeah, I mean, we learned the hard way with alcohol licensing. I have to say, it was like, that was, you know, one of the reasons that in Mexico, it was really easy not to have a license cap, because we're struggling with alcohol licenses that cost, you know, so much money. They themselves are a commodity.
Yeah, I mean, that was the neighborhood I grew up in Bergen County, New Jersey. And where we grew up, there were, you know, 75% of the restaurants I went to were BYOB. And it's like, you know, you go to an Italian restaurant and you can bring your own wine. I mean, that sounds cool for the consumer. But as someone who has family in the restaurant business, if you take, you know, alcohol away from the revenue stream, that's really tricky. And we saw a lot of businesses that, you know, they would have much rather been able to sell you a bottle of wine at a 400% markup than let you go next door, buy it for $9 and drink it while you have dinner. And I think that, you know, that's, I think most consumers would rather be able to just go to a restaurant and have them have a selection available. And we see that, I think, in a lot of other states. And so, yeah, that probably does play an influence when you commoditize something. I think of taxi cab medallions in New York City when I was a kid, and like taxi cab medallion would be worth $2-3 million. And it's like, well, it's not actually, it has no economic utility. It is a government created commodity that has been artificially limited, right? Like it only has that value because the government has made it scarce, not because it is actually scarce. And so that's what we see in cannabis too, is these licenses that are worth tons and tons of money, not because of anything that is in the underlying business, but just because the government has created artificial scarcity and there's more demand for people who want to get into the business than there are licenses. And that's what happens, because supply and demand still exists. So I guess one of the things that we didn't touch on, we started getting right into the weeds of it. And I want to talk a little bit about, I know licensing timelines were a big part of everything. And that's probably the hardest section in the entire bill to understand, because it got rewritten like 100 times. And Bia, one of our associates, is like, I'm having trouble understanding the licensing sections. And I was like, don't feel bad. This is what happens when you amend a section so many times. But that is part of the sausage making process. But we alluded to it before when you mentioned HB 12 and HB2. And so just because this is probably one of the few podcasts where our listeners might actually care about technical process, New Mexico actually did have a little bit of wonkiness in terms of getting this bill passed. And can we talk a little bit about what happened with HB 12 and then the subsequent kind of special session and where we're at with some of all of these different issues getting done? Because I know there was some of the stuff that we care a lot about got stripped out of HB 12 to get HB 2 to pass.
Oh, I'd be interested in hearing what that is. So, yeah, I mean, HB 12 was moving along. It was, it sort of stalled. I mean, yeah, the sausage making. It stalled for a while to be heard in the Senate Judiciary Committee, which was the last stop before it went to the Senate floor. So by the time it got to the Senate floor, you know, we had basically 48 hours to get it through, knowing that it was going to be amended. It'd have to go back to the House for concurrence. It was also one of a handful of other really critical bills. You had Republicans threatening to filibuster, to debate on it for 14 hours. We knew that there'd be another 3-hour debate on the House side. So what it came down to, either we rammed this through and there were still some points of contention, or the governor calls a special session. And in the end, I think that was the right decision.
Yeah, I think that absolutely was. And I remember, you know, it wasn't for lack of trying, because I'm pretty sure there was a Saturday night somewhere along the journey where I gave up at around 12:15. And it was like, all right. And I remember my wife was like looking at me and being like, What the hell is going on here? It's like 10 o'clock on a Saturday night. She got out of the shower and was like, I'm going to go to bed soon. And I was like, I'm just still watching this committee meeting. And she's like, what? Like, who holds committee meetings at midnight on a Saturday at apparently New Mexico? When you have a 60-day session, you gotta rock late sometimes. And I've lived with it. We have 120 days in Colorado, thank God. So we mostly get our weekends off. But there was definitely a committee meeting, and I remember you getting called back in, and like you testified, and then they were like, "Wait," they asked more questions, and it was really the senators and representatives really was their time to answer questions. But they were like, "No, that one's for Emily. Phone a friend," and you jump back on the Zoom, and I'm just sitting there watching the show like on my couch in the basement, and I don't even know. Like, I think I got a text from our lobbyist at like, I mean, it went till about 1:30. Still didn't get a vote, was just more discussion and testimony. And then again on Monday, and I think on Tuesday, finally, like something like that, on Tuesday, it finally got a vote. And then they had to all be done by Thursday or Friday. The days run together without COVID.
It doesn't matter because it was just a blur. I mean, that's what it is. It's, you know, we don't get our weekends off. The special session, I think that I went straight on Zoom as an expert almost for 24 hours straight. We got a little break in there between like 2 a.m. and 9 a.m. I think was our break to get it passed. So yeah, that's New Mexico for you. We punish ourselves. But you know, that just shows that, you know, when you have a short period of time, time is not on your side. And that's really what happened at the end of the regular session. And so kudos to the governor for calling a special.
Yeah. And getting it done and making sure it got done. Now, one of the issues that I heard that was really causing some kerfuffle, and sometimes you can't tell if like an issue gets pointed to as like, you need to have something to point to. And it really is just some people don't like cannabis and aren't okay with it. But there was, at least what I heard from the outside, was there was some concern that the industry provisions had been coupled with record sealing and expungement efforts and things like that. And how was the interplay with those two things? And I guess more importantly, where did we end up when the bill passed? Like, where are we at with a record sealing and expungement perspective? And then we can talk about, well, you know, if there's work left to do, how do we get it done?
Yeah, so House Bill 12 included automatic record expungement and resentencing. And that's another reason why I think I'm really happy it went to a special session. So, you know, 11th hour in the regular session, there was a move to split out the expungement and the resentencing provisions, which, you know, everyone thought was the social justice piece, which made me laugh. I mean, that is a huge piece and it's critical, but no one realized that there is social justice and equity woven in and out of the rest of the bill. But for some people, they were just so narrowly focused on this expungement piece. That was the social justice piece. And they thought if they pulled it out, it had a better chance of passing. If that had happened at the end of the session, my worry was that we would have gotten just the Cannabis Regulation Act and expungement would have been left behind. So there was a decision going into the special session to keep those pieces separate, but we made sure that we got the commitment that they had to go together as a package, that it wasn't going to be one without the other. And that's what ended up happening. So actually New Mexico passed this great automatic expungement bill with resentencing, in addition to some professional licensing reform that was in a separate bill. So in the end, we ended up with an awesome package that the governor
signed. And what was that bill number so folks can go look it up? That's, and have Senate it as bill a reference.
Senate Bill 2. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, those are issues that states grapple with constantly. And it's an ongoing battle. It's something that we've been working on here in Colorado for years. And actually just last week passed a bill that we're running through the Senate in its first Senate committee. So we've got two votes left to go and then signed by the governor, which we're pretty certain we will. But it's something Colorado has been, you know, grappling with forever. Like, it, you know, in some ways it's awesome that we went first, because I have to be It was pretty sweet that I was not a criminal in the eyes of the state before residents in other states who never should have been treated as criminals. But at the same time, when you pave the way, it's hard to be as progressive as everyone that comes after you. And we have a lot of cleanup work to do. And we're working on it. And we've got a really strong social equity program that's being implemented at the state and local level. And we're certainly not done. And we've been working on record sealing and expungement. And I think the bill that we worked on this year is pretty technical, but we're excited about it. And, you know, I think everybody that worked on legalization, you know, would have loved to do it right at the same time. But it's, you know, it just wasn't in the Overton window. It wasn't possible then. And so we're working on it now. And it's amazing that you were able to get that done, because that's really the gold standard is kind of dealing with all of those things up front, making sure it's part of it. I mean, heck, we're still not ready for auto expungement here in Colorado. Unfortunately, we've been pushing for it for a while. This year, we're going to make it a lot easier for people's records to get sealed. We don't even have expungement. And then hopefully we're going to be able to work on auto in the next few years. But I'll tell you, in terms of like, got to teach yourself new areas of law, I didn't ever want to know in depth how criminal records work. And the more I learn, the more depressing it is, because basically they're just like paper records buried in basements of courthouses and police stations all over Colorado. And like none of it's digitized. And so record sealing becomes really hard. And so how did you bridge that gap? How did you deal with kind of like auto expungement? It sounds simple, right? It's like a pretty straightforward thing. If you know enough about drug policy and criminal justice reform, you probably know what that means. But the operations of it, I didn't realize that you open up this can of worms and you're like, oh boy, that is going to cost a pretty penny and take a lot of time to get done right.
Yeah, honestly, Jordan, I thought that this was the piece that was not going to happen going into the session for that reason. I mean, I would even talk to public defenders and they're like, oh yeah, no way. Like, we're not there yet. Our data systems aren't there. You know, just like you said, there's like paper records. We'll see. I don't know how it's going to get done, but it is now law and it has to get done. And I mean, even the governor, when she signed the bill, you know, had already had her Department of Public Safety do a query. And at that point, there were 150,000 people ready to have their records expunged when this goes live. I'm sure there's more than that, but, you know, I think sometimes it's just an excuse. I think government can do these things. It may take some extra resources, but people's lives are worth it. And I'm really proud to see New Mexico did that.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, the end of cannabis prohibition can, I think, mean two different things sometimes. It can either mean to you that society has moved beyond and cannabis is now not legal today and here forward. But I think what cannabis prohibition should mean is an acknowledgement from society that this was a dumb idea from the start and we never should have done this. And the only way that you can really acknowledge that this was a bad idea from the start and that, you know, you can't go back in time, you can't undo the harm that cannabis prohibition wrought on our society, but you can say, okay, I'm at least going to stop the harm from here forward as much as I can. And that's what auto expungement is, because it hurts people in the most personal of ways. It hurts their ability to get housing and get a job for their family and provide food and shelter. It can be used in divorce cases and impact parental rights and not just professional licensing. I think people always forget, one of the things I've gotten nerdy about over the years is like the child protective services and the interaction between both parental rights and as well as child protective services and cannabis use has a really long and muddied and sordid history. But auto expungement is a statement that like, this was always a bad public policy. We are going to move forward. And if you got arrested for cannabis possession 10 years ago, we're not going to let that be used as a weapon against you in a divorce proceeding so you can lose your children. You know, it's not going to be seen as a failing in those kinds of situations. We're not going to prevent you from getting housing. We're not going to prevent you from getting a job. You will be able to live a full life in society as if this never happened, because the arrest and the punishment was wrong in the first place.
Yep. I mean, really, when it came down to it, when the bill passed, the sponsors were getting calls about the expungement piece. That's what people cared about. And we knew we had done the right thing. I mean, they weren't necessarily calling and saying, how can I get a license? They were calling and saying, how can I get my record expunged? But you know, there's other language in the bill. You can expunge records, but a lot of states still penalize people for using cannabis, even when it's legal. And so we put some language in there, you know, that if you're on probation and parole, you can't be penalized. You know, it was changed a little bit because it's up to the judge, but around custody issues or just, you know, child protective services, you know, you can't have your health care denied or other benefits, you know, so it's also looking, you know, there are other things we have to do as we look forward into the future to make sure people are protected.
Yeah. And I love the fact that you mentioned the healthcare and the doctor situation. I always, even today in Colorado, and I'm a pretty out cannabis consumer at this point, but I always feel like, you know, I go to my doctor and they're like, do you smoke? And I'm like, I still like think to myself, like, how the heck do I spent most of my life lying about cannabis use to everybody in my life. And now I'm like, do I tell my doctor that I smoke weed? Do I not tell my doctor that I smoke weed? How do you, like, I think my doctor should know. Like, that would be a good thing for my doctor to be aware of as they advise me on maintaining health. But at the same time, like, if that goes in a report, how's that going to impact health insurance? I had to get life insurance because I have a wife and a kid, and it was on the list. And they were like, you have to go meet your, you have to go meet with a nurse. And she came to the office and did this like exam or whatever. And she asked me about my cannabis use. And I was honest, because the last thing in the world I want is like something to happen to me and my wife is going to try to collect and they deny the claim because I lied to the nurse. And I had to go through an entire second exam. We had to find a second provider because the first provider came back and the rates were basically like I was a 2-pack-a-day smoker. And we had to go back with the broker and find someone else who wasn't going to treat it like I was like a regular heavy tobacco consumer. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of little ways that that cannabis consumers have really, like, you know, it's like death by a thousand cuts in a lot of ways. And it sounds like one of the hallmarks of New Mexico legalization is going to be, we tried to address as many of those as we possibly could from the outset, because that's the most important thing, right? Equity is great. And the more diverse of an industry that we have, the better. But the truth is, cannabis prohibition harmed way more people than would ever start a cannabis business, right? Equity at its core is going to be letting all of the people that were harmed return to living a full life. And then if some of them want to start a cannabis business, that's great. But not all of them are going to want to. And we got to make sure that a lot of these other things are addressed and resolved as we move forward.
I totally agree. I mean, but one of the things that we fell short on in New Mexico, and it's something that we're going to be fighting for in the 30-day session, is reinvesting the dollars back into community. So you're right. I mean, we're not, more people have been harmed than are going to start businesses, but the revenue collected from those businesses should go back and into the communities that have been most harmed. And in New Mexico, you know, we're, as you know, a super poor state. We have one of the highest rates of child poverty. So earmarking dollars is not something our legislature feels comfortable with, because, you know, we just aren't a state that can afford to do that. But we're going to fight to make sure some of that goes back into the communities.
Yeah. And I think that it's just an ongoing battle that we need to win. I think that's the right thing to do. And, you know, it's when we talk about some of this auto expungement stuff in Colorado, they're like, where's the money going to come from? And I'm like, well, the cannabis community sends you guys hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And like, cannabis consumers actually care about this. This is like, it's our money. We're sending it to you. Like, we're all for school funding and mental health and all the good things that they do with it. But like, I also think that the things that matter to the cannabis community, which I think are things like record sealing, expungement, reinvestment in communities that are disproportionately harmed by the war on drugs. That's what the cannabis community cares about. And we should have a say in where our money is getting spent. Not that we don't want to support other things too, but at least some of it has to go to the stuff we care about. And I know I've never met anybody that's in the cannabis community that doesn't care about those things above all else, right? That we want to see the harm that was wrought upon our community undone to the extent that we can. And we're super down to support other good causes. And I love that cannabis tax scholars go to building schools and go to support mental health and go to deal with drug addiction treatment and opiate crises beyond just cannabis. But I also want that money for the things that matter to our community, which I think are, you know, like, it would be great if we could get a funding for a program to retrain child protective services folks to understand what cannabis really is and when it could be creating harm for a child versus when it's not. So that we don't have situations where people have, you know, like problems with their kids and their family because of this kind of stuff. And so I'm glad that, you know, everyone at DPA is committed to that fight in the long term, because this is not, you know, there's no way to undo the harm of 100 years of prohibition in one legislative session, right? This is going to be an ongoing journey.
I mean, and I think that comes down to, there was some pushback even by, you know, super progressive groups that it didn't go far enough. And we all know that, I mean, this is probably some of the biggest legislation that ever got passed in Mexico history in the last 50 years, right? And so we're going to just have to go back and improve it in those specific areas.
Yeah. What I like to say is, I will take all of the progress you are willing to give me today home. I will put it in the bank. And then I'm going to show up tomorrow and ask for more. And then when I get as much as I can get tomorrow, I will put it in the bank and show up the following day and ask for more. And I think that that's what drug policy reform as a movement needs to be, right? The goal is not to end cannabis prohibition, but cannabis prohibition is something that we can get today, and we will. And then we'll move on to everything else. And psychedelic reform is starting to take hold, and that's amazing. And I think we have a long way to go to recognize that criminalization is not the answer to people in our society that want to use drugs, whether they do it responsibly or irresponsibly. It's the prohibition that causes the harm, not the drugs themselves.
And you know, Oregon is an example of that. Something we've worked on, you know, that November's ballot showed that you can take a state and you can decriminalize drug use and possession, and you can take cannabis dollars to support that. And that's what happened in Oregon. So, you know, that's really where we're setting our sights on, you know, let's decriminalize all drug use and possession, and let's do it as a package. I don't disagree with, you know, psychedelic reform, but I think we need to not exceptionalize one drug over another, because we know the harms are pretty great when it comes to criminalization.
Yeah. And we just got to find, you know, that's why every single inch of progress that you can make, take it today. If Oregon's ready to decriminalize all drugs, go to town. If another state is only willing to decriminalize X, Y, and Z, take that, show up the next day and ask for everything else. The point is, this fight is going to continue, and the people working on it are going to be here continuing to do that fight. No matter how much we can get done today, we will be there tomorrow and continue to do this until we really achieve victory and really reform the way our society looks at all of these things. So as we kind of wrap up, and I just want to shift a little bit to the road ahead. And I know we're kind of coming up on time here, but it just give us a couple of minutes on, either, you know, what are the most interesting parts of the bill that we're going to watch play out, maybe rulemaking calendars, locals, like for folks who are interested in New Mexico, they can go read the bill themselves. You should read the bill, or at least read a summary of it, because it's a very good piece of legislation. But what are we going to look at over the next few months as the nitty gritty details get worked out during rulemaking, as locals start adopting ordinances? And then maybe most importantly of all, when are we all going to be able to travel to New Mexico, COVID aside, and participate in this amazing new market that you're creating?
So, you know, hats off to Superintendent Trujillo over our regulation and licensing department. She's jumping in head first right now. The bill doesn't even become law until June 29th. So, but they are getting a head start. So if folks are interested in listening from New Mexico, we have a regulatory advisory board, and they're taking applications to be part of that advisory board. I think applications are due May 1st. So that gives you a sense of like the urgency in which the department is moving forward. My guess is they'll start convening that advisory board. That in the statute, it doesn't say has to be convened until September of 2021, but my guess is that'll happen a lot sooner. Starting, you know, as soon as the law goes into effect at the end of June, that's when you can possess and cultivate. So there's a home cultivation provision in there. And then licensing will start soon after that. It can be no later. The production side, the licensing for production will start, you know, September or October. But you can't start purchasing until the bill says no later than April 1st, 2022. That doesn't mean it can't happen before that.
Yeah, and that's what we saw in Arizona. In fact, one of the meetings I had with he was a senator. The only thing they wanted to ask was like, how did Arizona get it done so fast and how can we be faster than them? And I was like, well, you can't replicate the market conditions that existed in Arizona prior to, but these are kind of the advantages they had, and you can try to do as much as you possibly can. And I, to me, that was an amazing conversation because it wasn't is this the right thing to do? It was more like, how can we get this done as quickly as possible? And I'm sure tax revenue had something to do with that. But at the same time, if cannabis consumers can go purchase a licensed, regulated product in a legal market, like, I don't care what the legislator's motivation for that to happen is. I just want to make darn sure that we can all actually engage in protected, safe, legal transactions as consumers and patients.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing I worry about with Arizona, and my understanding is it's really the licenses that are selling in Arizona are the medical cannabis licenses that have the head start. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But what that does is it doesn't help create equity. So on some level, I'm happy to see that, you know, sales for all license holders will start on the same date. There will be no head start for sales. There, you know, but we know that there'll be head starts on production. And those are the existing industry players who, you know, have the infrastructure to ramp up quickly. And so that's the difference, I think, between Arizona and I'm a fan of a slower rollout than a faster rollout because I think it'll be better. But we'll see. Time will tell.
Time will tell. And at the end of the day, I think, you know, what we want to do is make sure that we have an equitable market, right? And we have a fair market and we want to have an open market and not a restricted market. And I think that's what New Mexico really has put together, an opportunity for folks big and small to get into the space, and timelines that will allow the existing industry to move in, the new entrepreneurs to move in, equity entrepreneurs to move in. And I believe, did it come out in the end, or was there a tasting room style hospitality provision, right? Which that's my thing. Like, I think the most important thing as we move forward is actually allowing cannabis consumers to leave their house and socialize, which I think after a year of isolation, we can all agree we probably need each other and we need those hugs from family and friends even more. And so, you know, we were at a Memorial Happy Hour for Steve Fox this week in Washington, D.C. And I was talking to some of the MPP folks and friends from drug policy reform. And I was like, it's ridiculous that we're at a bar. Like, why aren't we at a restaurant that serves cannabis instead of alcohol if we're going to memorialize Steve Fox? And it's because we still got a lot of work to do. And we're going to continue doing that work and we're going to continue fighting that fight. And eventually we'll maybe kind of achieve the goal of really moving beyond cannabis prohibition and stigmatization in our society. But it ain't going to happen today. It's going to take years and years of work. So,
To your point though, that New Mexico does have supervised consumption areas. So that did stay in the bill.
Yeah. And I think with a state that has such amazing tourism and reasons for people to go visit, I think that's going to be an important part. So people can go to do awesome stuff like Meow Wolf or visit Santa Fe or many of the other amazing, beautiful national parks in New Mexico and actually not be like, okay, I'm going to go hide in my hotel room and smoke weed, because we all love hiding in our hotel room and smoking weed. And the hotels really love it when cannabis consumers smoke weed in the hotel room too. So consumption areas are a win-win for everybody.
They are. And we can't forget that another reason that they're good is that a lot of people live in housing that doesn't allow cannabis use. And so from a social justice perspective, consumption areas are important.
Yeah, absolutely. Here. That is so true. I think it's kind of, you know, the linchpin of how we need to move forward. So I know we're coming up on the end. I guess before we wrap, is there any other parting things you'd like to share or any other quick things you'd like to say about the victory that you just achieved?
I'm tired, but relieved and excited for the next year. I think the hard work begins now, right? You know better than anyone. The rulemaking is critical. and a super important part of it. So we're going to be there to help in the way, any way we can make this a successful rollout, and then be back next legislative session to improve the bill.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, rest up, because rulemaking is really important and the nitty gritty actually matters and impacts people's lives, as dorky as it can be sometimes. So with that, I'd just like to say thank you so much, not just for coming on the podcast today and sharing the story with us, but for all the work that you've done over years and years and years for cannabis consumers in New Mexico, for folks like myself that can't wait to visit New Mexico and not be a criminal when I get down there. You know, it really was a hard lift, but you guys have made the world a much better place, and I look forward to all of the amazing things that you're going to do in the future. So thank you so much from everybody in the cannabis community for what you've done and what you will continue to do. And hopefully we'll touch base with you in the coming months as things continue to evolve, and look forward to even maybe being able to meet you in person one day and not just virtually. So thank you so much for everything that you do. And with that, we will just say stay nerdy, everybody. All right, Shay, make the magic.